Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Movie Geeks United Independent Film Spotlight. Tonight, we'll be chatting with the writer, director, and star of The Red Robin, an exciting new atmospheric thriller starring Judd Hirsch and Ryan O'Nan. This terrific film is currently making the rounds in festivals across the country and overseas, and you can read more about it at theredrobin.com. In this conversation, we speak with writer-director Michael Wexler and one of the film's lead actors, Ryan O'Nan.
You still have nightmares, Julie?
I think I've gotten over your ghost stories by now.
I was supposed to tell you that they were real.
This whole house is part of some experiment. This isn't our home! And you...
This is called dissociative amnesia.
You need help.
He kept you in the dark like the rest of us.
Just need to believe that nothing went wrong in this house.
How would I know this space if I've never seen these pictures?
That place was sealed decades ago.
I know that room!
I know that room too. Somebody please tell me what the hell is happening.
MK Ultra. I was a lead psychiatrist.
You're saying that you're one of those scientists in Tommy's story?
No matter how deep you dig, the only thing you'll find is more lies.
Mary!
I'm not the monster in the closet with the electrodes and the drills.
Oh my God.
What are they for? Torture chamber?
Our kids, when we found them, weren't they past the breaking point?
This is a joke, right?
It was never a story, Tommy.
Peter, stop it!
Just tell me what I need to know.
Did you experiment on our children?
First of all, Michael, what was the inspiration to kind of put pen to paper and draft out The Red Robin for you?
Yeah, well, for me, you know, I've been writing for probably about 20, 25 years. Scripts and every screenplay kind of comes to me in a different way. Sometimes you have the whole premise, you know, in a nice, convenient, you know, pitch sentence. Other times it's a little bit more piecemeal, and that, I think that best sort of describes how, you know, the genesis of the Red Robin screenplay and how it sort of evolved rather than kind of like, boop, light bulb, there it is. First and foremost, I really enjoy writing screenplays and stories about characters who have to work through a lot of issues. Specifically, I think when I say issues, specifically have some form of trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. These are just sort of things that I really like to put into the stories I've written, whether they are dramas or comedies or, in this case, a psychodrama. And so I knew, like, 2005 when I was starting to write a script, I wanted to do something that featured a character who had to go through, over the course of a story, you know, a journey where he really sort of understands himself and comes to terms with who he is and really kind of unscrambles the mysteries of his trauma. And so I kind of guess you'd say I had the sort of the theme. I knew that I wanted to set it against the foundations of family. I happened to, one of my favorite films of all times, Ryan knows, this is The Celebration, also known as Festin, back in 1998, about one family undergoing this crisis where a son is trying to out the father who, you know, could do no wrong with all these secrets, and takes place over the course of one evening. I think that story really had a strong impact on me. But I've always loved stories about secrets and families having to sort of uproot themselves and short periods of time, long days, journey to night, Eugene O'Neill, for example. So I had those things, and I started writing 60 pages. It really wasn't much of a premise in there. I just started writing ideas and characters basically coming together to celebrate a father's, you know, final birthday, a father's passing. And Tommy, who's played by Ryan O'Nan, Tommy in the movie is looking at the beginning of the story for his dog who was buried or cremated in an urn. That urn story is actually based on something that did sort of happen to me and sort of is the next piece in the puzzle in the evolution of the story. I grew up with a dog, family dog, cherished him, everyone in our family, he was a member of our family. When he passed, we put him in an urn, and the urn was left in my childhood home. many, many, many years later, my parents moved. I went off to college, and then I moved out to L.A. to try to make it in the film business. Long story short, I went back to visit my folks in their new home, and I asked them, you know, where was the dog urn? And they said, oh, we buried it in the childhood home. And so, of course, I was a little bit distraught because I was very close with that dog, and to me, I wanted to always have some connection to him more than just pictures and memories. And so I sort of in my mind sort of set out to go back to that house, knock on the door, and ask him to give me a couple of hours to unearth my dog. Of course,
crazy.
Crazy makes good cinema. Hey. So anyway, to make a long story short, I basically never did that. But when I started writing these 50 or 60 pages, that character with that need was in there. So I had this Tommy character early on. I had the family, the members of the family who were spending time with the father, you know, who was dying of lung cancer and having his last birthday. But I didn't really know what Tommy was looking for. In my mind, as a writer, I knew he really wasn't looking for a dead dog. That seemed too much like a comedy. And I wanted this to be a mystery with secrets and all sorts of things to unearth.
Dead dogs are so funny.
Hey, do we have like a little timpani drum we can hit every time Mr. Onan gives a
joke? Yeah, yeah. So Ryan, when you got a hold of the script, what about it spoke to you, and what about Tommy appealed to you?
I always love characters like Mike said that have secrets, and the fact that it dealt so intimately with family. I have a big family three brothers and a sister, and we're all very, very close. And this family is actually very, very close. The family in Red Robin is really close. And yet there's this, like, unspoken conflict that they all deal with at the center. And I feel like that's the kind of stuff that happens on, you know, when you're squeezed together on a holiday or a birthday or just the pending knowledge that your father is about to pass, and like all that stuff that it brings up. And so it was really fun as I read it, that because I didn't know what to believe. You know, when Tommy says what he says and accuses Judd of his father of this stuff, you are on Tommy's, you're not on Tommy's side, you're on Judd's side. You're thinking, like, how is this
right.
kid ruining his father's final birthday? And then it slowly slips around to there's something obviously wrong with C.S.'s character, maybe something's wrong with him. And then the older brother, then all of a sudden he's like this, what is the word for that? You're always, is it
McGovern?
Scapegoat, like, like where you think it's him, and then you're, I mean, it really goes to the ringer. Like, could be the mom for all we know. You know, you have no idea. So, and then all of a sudden, when it kind of is unearthed that Tommy is telling the truth, or you know, he's convoluted it in some weird way, but the center of it is truth. I found that fascinating. All of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, and all the stuff that Mike had sent me, a ton of stuff. Interviews, all those interviews that he spoke about with the MK Ultra stuff, I had no idea about, and was
it's also such a different character for you from what I've seen of your film work, and I'm a huge fan of yours. I mean, I love what you do.
Thank you, man.
This guy is, he's tortured, and it's a complete 180 from the other film that you have out, the Chew and Blossom, who is about as extroverted as you could get. That character, I would think that would be a great challenge for you to go kind of the opposite direction with a character like Tommy.
Yeah, you know, I did a movie called The Dry Land that was about a soldier coming back from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder, and coming back to his family and that kind of secret that he had that he couldn't share with anybody, and yet it was kind of like eating away at his soul. And I did so much research on PTSD and interviewed so many people that were dealing with this in real life. I mean, people that had attempted to take their lives and all this stuff. So I think that I have a great sympathy for that stuff. And so But Tom, I mean, Tommy's on, I feel like Tommy's actually on a whole another level, though, because he doesn't know what's real and what's not, and he has actually been, you know, messed with in a very psychological way that has totally skewed him, and for his whole life. It's not just one event that messed him up. I mean, for Tommy, it's one event that was attempted to be corrected by his father, which built upon itself, which built upon some kind of strange mythology that he has slowly come to believe in and yet is rejecting at the same time. It was a fun kind of rabbit hole to go down.
Well, you mentioned the family dynamics, and you know, we always in every one of our families, we have a different kind of chemistry with each member of our family.
Right.
But I understand in independent film shoots, there's very little time to rehearse or get acquainted before you have to actually shoot. So, did you, Ryan, communicate with each actor to kind of define those relationships for yourselves?
You know, I don't think we actually met prior to it. I don't think we met until we were down there. But
we did. You met at the reading, most of them. That was the
reading?
One time, I think. We had a reading. You remember we had a reading in New York City one afternoon in a costume fitting? You don't know that? Yeah, we
I
had
totally
a reading. That was the first time. Yeah, everyone was there except Jamie and Joe.
I mean, that's like
I think
more
I
than
must,
half
I
people.
Must, I, yeah, it was, but it was just a reading. It was like a sit-down for a few hours, not really an opportunity to, you know, get too much in depth. With everything.
That's so crazy. I don't remember that in the slightest bit. But but I will say that I've become really close with the people that played my siblings in that, like at my birthday party last night, which is like my kind of close friend. Both Jamie Ray Newman and C.S. Lee were both there, and me and C.S. just spent like a week down to this film festival together, and Jamie is really close to me, and her husband, actually, we're like writing partners now. It's been that project actually really brought a lot of us really close together, which is so nice about film. You know, it's kind of abnormal in that you have a month that you get kind of like sit down, you know, stuck with these people that you've never met before, and you know, you're kind of forced to become really close in some way, because that's the only way that it kind of will end up hopefully seeming natural on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really nice thing, actually.
So Michael, a movie like this, I mean, it's very it gets gradually darker and darker, and the atmosphere in this film is amazing. But is there a danger of setting too much of an ominous tone too early? I mean, you have to kind of calibrate how that builds, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we calibration is definitely something that took place, I think, especially during the editorial process and figuring out how much did we want to establish and give away early on in the story, you know, the kind of dark turn that this, you know, that the Red Robin was going to take. And you know, I think we always wanted people to sort of come into this film, you know, knowing that, feeling the sort of that there's something unsettling, but really just assuming it's that a family is really paying its final goodbyes to the patriarch. And I really wanted people to think, well, this is going to be, you know, our last warmer moments with this family, you know, trying to make the best of it, of a really negative or tragic situation. And then I wanted to just slowly give you glimpses, really through Tommy, when you see Tommy in the first act, really through Tommy that maybe that something is, you know, something is not as normal as it seems. There is a darkness, and that we're going to see a little bit more of that as the story unravels. It really is, you know, the risk of a story like this is that, you know, you're going to make it so gloomy and so dark that people are just going to want to shoot themselves 60 minutes through the film, because it's you're asking a lot for people. You're asking people a lot to suffer through. It's already a very difficult situation, thing of a father, but also doing in a very sort of claustrophobic environment. for almost 90 minutes, literally in one house, one location, a few times jumping outside, sure, you're asking a lot. And I think this is why it was important. There isn't really any humor in this movie at all, but it was important for me and the casting to have, more importantly than any other, I think, role, really the father and the son. And they're the central characters, the roles played by Ryan and Judd, for us to be able to relate to them. And even though Ryan is, you know, struggling through something that we really don't understand, and he doesn't understand, you know, Tommy, rather, that somehow we can connect with him emotionally. Somehow that, you know, he can still take us on this journey. We could still want to go with him because there's something about him that is accessible, you know. And, you know, Judd, of course, as we were talking about before, Judd has this sort of, you know, he's sort of like the beacon of sanity, you know, in this house and in many roles that he plays. And I think you just naturally trust him. And it was important, though, it was important that this sort of ominousness was balanced by, you know, characters that you could find some sort of touchstone, some sort of relatability towards. And I tribute and credit Ryan, really, because he is the protagonist, with being able to make us want to go on that journey and not alienate us. I think there's a lot of situations, and this was really important to me in the casting phase, a lot of situations where you have characters who are unhinged in motion pictures. And a lot of times it can feel one note, or you can feel immediately like, oh, I enjoy their performance, but I don't feel their humanity. I don't feel the pain and the suffering that makes me want to pay attention and care about them. That was what, you know, Ryan definitely had that. And he, as he was saying before about Dryland, I mean, he suffers and you suffer with him, and you suffer with him in a way that you want to go through the journey with him. So, you know, it's really, you know, that I think in the end, I wish I could have gone back to the script and maybe put a couple of jokes in the first 30 pages just to kind of ease the...
You were talking about calibrating, and you had, correct me if I'm wrong, Sidney Lumet's last editor working with you on the film.
Yes, yes, Tom. Tom Swartout. He is an amazing ally. He's become one of my dearest friends, and I'm really lucky. I'm like the luckiest director. You know, it's what I said to him every day. I'm like... as long as I am allowed to continue to make movies, I hope that you'll continue to join me in this process. You know, wonderful, wonderful, talented, creative force who, you know, he just has a way of, he's a way, I think an editor, I'm an editor, by the way, so when I talk about this, I kind of know from whence it comes, but a lot of times the job of an editor, it's obviously creative is the most important, but it's also being able to deal with, you know, directors of varying experiences, or varying amounts of experience, and, you know, and being able to talk to them in a way that doesn't make them feel as if you're going to destroy their work, or you're going to throw out the babies that they've worked so hard to bring to life. And it's in many ways, it's kind of therapeutic. And Tom used to say to him, I'm like, Tom, okay, we're going to do some editing today, and then we're going to talk about how I feel about cutting these five scenes emotionally. And he was just, he always was able to put me at ease. He was originally Sydney's first editor, assistant editor to Sydney's main editors.
But he was an assistant on Night Falls in Manhattan, I think.
Yes.
And then he became the lead editor, yeah.
And then he became the lead editor. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Sidney Lumet in every single film that he's done. And so I felt very, you know, I was a little bit starstruck, you know. Ryan O'Nan, he didn't really starstruck me, but, you know, I have to say. No, Ryan, you did. I loved you the minute I saw you.
This movie was really, really created in post, and you know, the different journeys that it went through. And Mike, you know, and I, having directed a film myself that I've written, I know how hard it can be to kill those babies. And Mike had to kill a lot of babies in the film. I mean, literally, there's two children, small children in the film that were killed, like, or were taken out completely.
Taken out. Mm. Careful.
But there was two more
siblings. Yeah, I mean, James
Duong can
be
film.
Like, yeah, Mike Wexler, good guy, goes out and kills his actors. That's really cool.
I love this conversation because we've been talking about dead dogs and killing babies. It's been great.
Well, anyway. that should be the title of this podcast. Yeah, that's for sure.
I think so. So tell me, Ryan. I mean, speaking of being starstruck, here you are sharing a stage with Judd Hirsch, who is such a commanding yet very relaxed presence as an actor, and you guys are going to work on some really meaty scenes. That had to be such a huge thrill.
I mean, it really was, man. I mean, I have always loved Judd's work. I mean, I loved Ordinary People, and I actually grew up, I mean, it wasn't on for that long, but I loved Dear John. Taxi was a little bit before my time, so I didn't see much of that, but I really did love that show, Dear John. I actually got a thrill watching Breaking Bad the other day that one of the guys from Dear John plays the, like therapist in that show, and I was like, Dear John! I love that shit so much. I just find him such a wonderful actor, and he's so generous, and on set, actually, he was very collaborative and just a jokester. I mean, he had fun the whole time. We all hung out and talked about our lives and joked around and kept it really jovial. And I think a big part of that is because the material was so heavy that can kind of, you can trudge around in it for a while, or you can choose to, you know, just enjoy each other when the cameras aren't rolling, and I think that makes the material deeper. And you know, I learned a lot about that from Judd while we were filming.
So tell me what it's like. For instance, this past weekend, I know you guys have played festivals before this past weekend, but this past weekend you were at Gasparilla. So just talk to me about the nerves or the exhilaration of unveiling your film to an audience and kind of hearing their reaction to it.
Well, you know, this is the sixth festival for the Red Robin. So we've traveled a bit. We've been, I just came back from Fantas Porto, which is a festival in Porto, Portugal, and then Glasgow, and then before that we were in Montreal, and then Oaxaca. So we've done we've been to some really interesting places and many, you know, much different kinds of audiences. I think before screening, you know, you're always nervous because, you know, you're nervous about a lot of things. You're nervous about, will the movie, you know, will the projection system actually work? Have I given them something that will, you know, will my Blu-ray, you know, break down? You know, it's like ridiculous things like that, which are very technical. But then there's, of course, the thing that's out of your control as a filmmaker is you know, it's the audience reaction. And so but my last film I made, which was back in 1999, it was a much different film, the genre. It was a dramedy called Slaves of Hollywood, about people working their first jobs in the film business, kind of a mockumentary docudrama of sorts. And you were able to watch that movie with an audience and viscerally know whether or not they were enjoying it because they were laughing where they were supposed to laugh, or they weren't enjoying it because they weren't laughing at all. So you kind of know with a comedy, it's a little bit easier to see whether or not they're going on the ride with you. With something like this, what I've realized is that, you know, the first couple of times screening this, I'd be like, everybody's so quiet, you know? but of course you're like, well, what are they supposed to do, scream? There's not a horror movie, and they're not going to laugh because there's no jokes. And I would just try to figure out, well, what was it, how do I gauge whether or not they like it? You know, during the screening, for example, and what I realize now, it's like a couple of things that for me are litmus tests, especially with a psychological thrill, like a slow burn kind of movie like this. How many times are people checking their phones? Because people do check their phones a lot these days in this, you know, ADD, you know, phone world that we live in right now. And also, how many times are they shifting in their seats? So basically, those two things during the movie, if I saw very few of those during actual festival screenings, that to me was always a really good sign. You know, of course, there's always somebody who's just not going to get the movie at all, and they're going to be on their phone. But I'm talking about, like, you know, you see a whole row lighting up, and you're like, what the hell is that all about? So, you know, that to me is the telltale signs. After the film is over, We've had different kinds of, it's really based on the screening. You know, who are the people in your screening? It's really kind of a roll of the dice, because you might find people who love this type of genre that happen to all watch come into your screening at this festival. And so, you know, afterwards, they're probably going to get up and clap and ask you a million questions. Or you might get people who are like, you know, who like, you know, stuff that's much different fare, you know, had expectations that weren't met, and so there'll be complete silence. So it's kind of it's a crapshoot, I guess, and I just kind of go in and just try to soak in the experience, and how few people really get to watch an audience from different parts of the world see their movie. That's such a treat, you know, and I just look at it that way, and regardless of whether or not they, you know, regardless of whether or not they like it, you know, I feel like if it's, I'm getting an opportunity that few people are really, you know, being able to have in their life. So I feel very fortunate, you know. I think the other thing is, I was going to say this, you know, this movie ends in a very sort of, not ambiguous way, but it doesn't end with like a emphatic punctuation. It ends with the sort of like ... you know, what's going to happen, you know, the audience has to sort of fill in the blanks. And I think that because the ending is the way it is, and because people have gone through this mind-numbing, you know, unsettling experience for 90 minutes, I think a lot of people tend to feel a little wiped out after watching this movie. Not in a bad way, but I think wiped out, like a lot of people tend to be quiet after they watch the film, is what I've noticed. And I don't think that's a negative thing necessarily. I think that's, somebody came up to me after Gasparilla, after our first screening, the next day. And it was somebody who I kind of befriended before the screening. And so right after the screening, after the first screening, they said goodnight. And I was like, oh, okay, that was quick. I thought I'd get a couple of words. I guess he didn't like the movie. The next day he saw me in the theater, and he sat down. He said, I have to talk to you. He's like, is there any way they can make the Q&A happen later?
Yes.
And I was like, I was like, why? I was like, no, they can't, but why? He's like, your movie? He's like, I didn't see it coming. He's like, I didn't see where it was going. He's like, and it was, I needed to really process it. He's like, I didn't ask any questions. I didn't talk to you because I really needed to think about it. And he's like, I said, well, you know, unfortunately, that's not how it works at the festivals.
That's,
you know,
exactly.
And then
what
he was able to ask
say.
Me questions. What's that?
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say, because it is one of those movies that you feel like you need to kind of marinate in for a while after you watch it, because it is so kind of provocative, and it does deal with characters and issues that, you know, require some thought before you kind of formulate an opinion on. So those are the best kinds of movies. So tell me what the plans are for the Red Robin at this point. Is it continuing the festival circuit, or...?
We're continuing the festival circuit. We have a couple other festivals that are lining up right now. We got a sales company that is really hard at work trying to sell us around the world. And, you know, they're basically trying to sell us around the world and also North America. And so we're kind of waiting on results from the European film market, which happened about a month ago. And they're taking it to Cannes, and they're taking it to Toronto. So, you know, as a filmmaker, I'm trying to... I'm kind of getting ready for the eventual time when this movie will come out on VOD, because that's eventually where all our movies go these days, VOD and probably some kind of limited theatrical release in L.A., in New York City, and maybe a few other major cities. I'm trying to build the social network. That's kind of my thing. So I'm trying to build up my Twitter, and I'm trying to build up the Facebook page, and I'm trying to really find, like, audiences, I think, that groups of people that I think would actually find this type of movie to be, you know, in their wheelhouse. So, you know, hopefully within, you know, the next couple of months we'll have a better idea of where we're heading. You know, as a filmmaker, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. It's, like, great to have a sales company you believe in and it believes in you, but at the same time it's like you have to succeed, you know, control over of the project that you've been in control of for, like, you know, almost a decade maybe, and that's frustrating, because you're like, wait a second, I want to do this or I want to do that, and, you know, at this point, you know, letting the professionals do their job and hoping that the marketplace responds, you know, and that's kind of where we're at.
In terms of building social media, your website is theredrobin.com. Now, can they find your Twitter and Facebook and everything like that there?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter feed Red Robin and also Facebook Red Robin as well. So those are pretty easy to find.
Ryan, what's coming up for you?
I actually am leaving in the morning. I'm going to shoot a movie in Alabama called Vice with Bruce Willis and Thomas Jane. I play Thomas Jane's partner in this kind of sci-fi futuristic fun movie. And then I'm making a new movie that the writer director Samuel Brett Williams is doing, and I'm producing it and acting in it. And we're shooting it out in Arkansas in May. And that's a really fun one. I'm really excited about that. And those are the two kind of acting things on the horizon as of right now.
Well, you know, Bruce Willis and Thomas Jane, that's not bad.
I'm very excited. I love sci-fi stuff, too. So, and I haven't really done a sci-fi movie before, so I'm excited.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm a huge fan of the movie, and I'm big fans of you guys. And thank you so much for giving me time to talk about the Red Robin. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, James.
Oh,
really
thank you very much for having us, man.
Yeah, man.
Thank you, guys. Enjoy your trip tomorrow to the film set in Arkansas or Alabama, you said?
Alabama tomorrow. I've actually been to all 50 of the states except for three, and Alabama is one of them, and I get to cross it off tomorrow.